From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, he's good enough, he's smart enough, and doggone it, people like him. He's Stuart Smalley, and he's addicted to 12-step programs. We'll talk with Al Franken, who created the character of Stuart Smalley for Saturday Night Live. We'll also talk with Franken about the presidential campaign. He writes a lot of the political humor on Saturday Night Live, and he's co-anchored coverage of the presidential campaign for the Comedy Central channel. Also, we'll talk with conservative editorial cartoonist Wayne Stascoll. He's probably one of the few political cartoonists who won't make fun of Dan Quayle. And film critic John Powers reviews the new movie Zebrahead about an interracial couple in high school. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush's claims that he was out of the loop of Reagan administration decisions to swap arms to Iran for American hostages were contradicted today in an indictment handed down against former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Weinberger was charged today with lying to Congress about whether he took notes of the internal Reagan administration debate over the Iran-Contra affair. One of Weinberger's handwritten notes summarizes a January 7, 1986 meeting in the Oval Office. It places then-Vice President Bush at that meeting, agreeing with President Reagan's decision to sell 4,000 TOW missiles in exchange for five American hostages. The note adds that Weinberger and then-Secretary of State George Shultz opposed the deal. President Bush has maintained that he did not know that arms were being traded for hostages until December 1986, almost a year later. Mr. Bush has also claimed that he was not aware that Weinberger and Shultz opposed the deal. The Weinberger note appears to contradict Mr. Bush on both points. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The UN Security Council demanded an immediate end to the fighting in Angola today, threatening action against any party that violates the peace accords. There were reports of heavy fighting around the capital city, Luanda, and in the central part of Angola. The UNITA rebel movement was said to be on the offensive in about a dozen towns. UNITA and its leader, Jonas Savimbi, lost parliamentary elections last month, but agreed to a runoff with President José Eduardo dos Santos. The UN Security Council said that any party that fails to live up to its commitments will be rejected by the international community. The Reuters news agency quoted European diplomats who said that means that any government organized by force by UNITA would be isolated economically and diplomatically. A controversial amnesty bill has won approval in South Africa today, making it likely that government officials and security forces will be given greater protection from prosecution for crimes committed against anti-apartheid activists. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The amnesty proposal was endorsed today by the President's Council, an executive body controlled by President F.W. de Klerk's National Party. The Council's decision overrides action by the South African Parliament, where the amnesty failed after complaints that it would grant blanket protection to those who repressed blacks in the name of the apartheid regime. The African National Congress has warned that it will overturn the amnesty if it wins elections that are expected as part of a transition to majority rule here. Despite that warning, de Klerk pushed hard for the bill, claiming that it was needed before he could release certain political prisoners loyal to the ANC. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
The Dow Industrials lost nearly 20 points today to close at 3,226. This is NPR. President Bush and Bill Clinton focused their attacks on one another's economic proposals today. The president said Clinton favors trample-down economics, a play on the Democrats' efforts to link him with so-called trickle-down economics that favor the rich. Clinton blamed the Bush administration for declining incomes, rising unemployment, and an increase in the number of the so-called working poor. The international human rights organization Amnesty International is trying to get more attention paid to the plight of Haitian refugees. Melissa Mancini reports from Miami.
A 64-foot boat named Honor and Respect has taken to the seas with nine Amnesty International members aboard. The crew were searching for U.S. Coast Guard cutters intercepting Haitian refugees. Amnesty's Kurt Gehring says the group is protesting the U.S. policy of interdicting and forcibly repatriating the Haitians.
We're not intending to violate any international or U.S. law. We intend this to be a direct action form of protest. Our other methods that we've used have not resulted in a change of policy.
Currently, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering the constitutionality of the administration's policy toward the Haitians. A ruling is expected next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
Top agriculture officials from the United States and the European Community will meet next week in Chicago in an effort to clear away the last obstacles to a worldwide trade agreement. The Department of Agriculture said that EC Farm Commissioner Ray McSherry and U.S. Agriculture Secretary Edward Madigan will meet on Sunday and Monday. A USDA spokesman said the meeting was being held to follow up on negotiations that took place over the telephone this week. The U.S. and the EC are at odds over European farm subsidies and U.S. barriers to trade in commercial services. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1980s was the Al Franken decade, but the 90s belonged to Stuart Smalley. My guest Al Franken has been associated with Saturday Night Live for many years as a writer, performer, and co-producer. Over the past couple of years on the show, he's been satirizing the recovery movement through his character Stuart Smalley. Stuart is a caring nurturer who is addicted to 12-step programs and dispenses advice on how to keep a positive attitude. Now Franken has created a book of Stuart's daily affirmations and an audio tape of his guided visualizations. They're both called I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me.
I'm going to do a great guided visualization tape, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. Hello, I'm Stuart Smalley, and welcome to You're Good Enough, You're Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like You, a healing journey through the dysfunctional forest and other guided visualizations. It's a long title, but that's okay. It's appropriate. Now, before we go any further in this tape, I do want to start with a little warning. Guided visualizations are powerful stuff, and hopefully the visualizations on this tape will transport the you inside of you, or whatever, and free that inside person to be the best you inside of you that you can be. But I think I would be remiss if I did not tell you that I am not a licensed therapist, and while I am being paid to do this, I am not a professional in the therapeutic sense. And I do worry that I will misuse this power and really screw somebody up, you know, accidentally. So, while the whole point is to relax and surrender yourself to the tape so that you can be transported to a healing place, just keep an eye out, and you know, if you're beginning to freak or something, you know, just pull out. Okay, I'm beginning to think this was a mistake, the warning. The whole point is to feel safe, and I think this is just scaring people. Can we cut the tape?
Why don't we start with you running through some of the many 12-step programs that Stuart Smalley has been in?
Okay, Stuart is in five. OA, because he's powerless over food, and it's Overeaters Anonymous. Al-Anon, first ACOA, I guess, Adult Children of Alcoholics. As Stuart says, my father is an active alcoholic, a big stinking drunk. And he's in Al-Anon, which is for family members of alcoholics. Thanks again, Dad. Then he's in Debtors Anonymous. I'm a anorexic spender. I have difficulty spending money on myself, as you can see from this sweater. Oh, I'm sorry, this is radio. And he is in CODA, which is Codependence Anonymous. It covers a lot of the same area, you know, material as Al-Anon. And I get more out of Al-Anon. But, you know, if you get more out of CODA, good. Good for you. Whatever.
Now, how did you come up with the kind of whiny voice that you use for the character?
You know, the voice, it's funny. Sometimes when you write something, it comes with a voice, and this just did. And I don't know why exactly, other than maybe there are a few people. I actually belong to one of those groups. I belong to an anonymous fellowship for friends and family members of drunks or recovering alcoholics, too. And I think there were a number of people in rooms that I've met who sort of remind me of Stuart. And I guess the reason I came up with Stuart and the way he is that one of the great things I learned going to this fellowship is that I can learn stuff from people who I never in a million years thought I could. And so I sort of deliberately made Stuart pretty, you know, pretty silly and lame in a lot of ways, but very kind of courageous and sweet and vulnerable in his own way.
I think that's one of the things I really love about the character, is that you do kind of have it both ways. You know, it's like really funny and you're really mocking the character, and at the same time you could tell you have a real kind of affection and caring for him too.
Well, actually, people who know me very well know that there's a lot of Stuart inside of me. A lot of the insecurity and a lot of the self-doubt and all that stuff. And I think it's in a lot of people. And part of one thing Melody Beattie, who wrote the preface to the book, she wrote Codependent No More. One of the things we were discussing early what she was going to write, and she said something about the book giving people the permission, giving themselves the permission to have the Stuart inside of them.
Oh, and thanks.
I thought that was really nice, because I think there are parts of all of us that are very vulnerable and very, you know, can be stupid at times. And mm-hmm. I think it's okay, you know, it's fine to give yourself permission to do that and not, you know, beat yourself up.
How do you deal with some of the language of the recovery movement, which you mock a lot, but also probably have some respect for it too? Like Stuart's always saying, you know, that, well, this isn't my best show, but that's okay.
Right.
So there's all this, like, affirmation in the language.
Well, affirmations are, I mean, first of all, program has this incredible amount of jargon.
Yeah.
And the jargon is usually just a shorthand for some concept. So all it really is just a way for someone to grasp, hold on to a concept. And most of these concepts are pretty sound. And so, but the jargon can get pretty grating and silly. And yet, when the concept has helped you so much and the way you got to the concept was through the jargon, you kind of hold on to the jargon. So that's Stuart is a program junkie, so he is a jargon junkie. So actually, people send me these things. I got one the other day, which is, fear is a dark room where negatives get developed. Which is a gift through the mail. So if you're listening and you got good ones, send them to me. Stuart will use them.
What are some of your other favorites?
Another one someone sent to me was, it's easier to put on slippers than to carpet the entire world.
Yes, I like that a lot.
And there's one I'm doing that I heard in program that I'm using this week, because Stuart is going to be on the show this week. He's apologizing for yesterday's show, which is what he always does. And he evidently took Madonna's inventory. And he says, this is a good thing to remember. He says, when you're pointing a finger at someone else, remember there are three fingers pointing back at you.
Now, tell me your reaction to this aspect of the recovery movement, the people who say humor is a good recovery tool.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart believes that.
Yeah.
he says, one of the affirmations is, today I will laugh at least once. And I've already laughed today, so I'm fine.
There are some people in the recovery movement who really do believe that humor is good therapy. So although they are humorless themselves, they have taught themselves like little jokes and little ways to be humorous. And they're very proud of it. And it's mm-hmm. a kind of like prescription for their health. Do you come across people like that? And I wonder how you react to them and how they react to you.
Well, you know, that's funny. As you said that, it's true. And it's the first time I've realized that, which I can't believe that's the first time I realized that. Thank you for No, it is true. There are people who I... because there are laughter in these rooms. By the way, there's much... I've gone to some open AA meetings, and there's a lot more laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous than in Al-Anon, which is really unfair if you think about it. But, no, there are... You're absolutely right. There are people who, just by nature... have no sense of humor, but know that it's a good thing and are working on it. and it's a really, really ugly thing to observe. But I, you know, God bless them. And I know. Well, that's their Stuart actually does have a terrible sense of humor, which is I use, for example, this week we're doing a Halloween show. So he's dressing as a skeleton, okay, because it's scary, and it reminds me that I'm a human being. And then Stuart has a little joke, which is, I was thinking of coming with something a little bit more original, you know, like dressing up as a feeling. But, you know, what does dread look like other than, you know, my mother? That's like Stuart's sense of humor. So, there are a lot of this jargon. To some extent, a lot of it has humor in it. But there are actually some very, very funny people in these. Actually, you know, the people have a preconception of people who go in the program, and it's just, you know, it's kind of wrong. But there are, some are thicker than others. So you'll be in a room, and some will be thicker than others.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Al Franken, and he has a new book, in the voice of the Stuart Smalley character that he created for Saturday Night Live. And the book is called I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me.
It's a long title, but that's okay. It's catchy.
We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Al Franken of Saturday Night Live is my guest. You've probably also seen him on Comedy Central, if in fact you have that and you have cable. And he also has a new book based on his Stuart Smalley character, which he created for Saturday Night Live. I think one of the really funniest Stuart Smalley sketches that you did for Saturday Night Live was about the genocide of the Kurds right after the war in the Gulf. Why don't I play an excerpt of this?
Hello. I'm Stuart Smalley. I've had a hard time focusing on myself this week because I've been so upset about what's happening in Iraq to the Kurds. It has been just a horrendous week for them. And so today I have decided to share my experience, strength, and hope with any Kurds who might be watching. First of all, when I've had a bad week, I try to remember to recite the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now, you are a Kurd. Can you change your situation? Probably not. It's out of your control. But what can you change? Your attitude. You are angry, and that's okay. You're entitled to your anger. You're angry at President Bush because he urged you to rebel against Saddam Hussein and then he abandoned you. He made a mistake, which is okay. President Bush is not perfect. He's a human being. Human beings make mistakes. And you're angry at Saddam Hussein, who is a very sick person, who obviously hates himself and is taking it out on you.
Al Franken, what gave you the idea of viewing genocide in the language of the recovery movement?
This actually, in your introduction to that, it was the first time I've heard genocide and funniest in the same sentence. I guess it's just that, you know, recovery, as said from earlier in the interview, I believe recovery works. It just has its limits. And Stewart is a character who is, you know, a recovery addict, and his whole life is seen through the prism of recovery. So he just wanted to comfort the Kurds, and it was sort of meant to sort of highlight the limit of recovery. And also, it's really one of the concepts that I have a tough time with in recovery is higher power and turning your will over to the higher power. Because as I'm Jewish and I was born in 1951, and I had sort of the Holocaust pounded into my head. And so it's always very hard for me to sort of turn my will over to a loving higher power who could have allowed that to happen. So, but again, higher power in the program is how you've come to understand him. And I work on that. So to me, what was happening to the Kurds that week was one of those, you know, one of those historical events which makes me doubt the existence of a benevolent higher power.
Now, have you met John Bradshaw, one of the heroes of the recovery movement?
You know, I have. I was talking to him about doing something together, and that thing's on hold right now. But we actually did discuss, you know, humor and recovery and the fact that if he did something with me, he might be criticized and that kind of thing. But he just said that, you know, that some people are at a more advanced stage of recovery than others, and that there are people don't think stuff is funny. But I have run into very, very little of that, really.
So what would you be doing with John Bradshaw?
Well, in the book, there's a little section where you follow. Stewart goes to the National Shame Conference to speak, and he feels like a fraud because all the other speakers there are recovery professionals, and Stewart, you'll remember, is not a licensed therapist. So Stewart actually kind of feels ashamed to be at the National Shame Conference, and he speaks there, and he's sort of over-prepared in a lot of ways. He has, like, slides and tapes and film and stuff like that, and it just becomes a disaster, and he runs off stage and cries and stuff like that, and John Bradshaw comforts him in the book, and I was talking to HBO about doing this as a little episode.
Yes, he writes, "I forgot to tell you John Bradshaw is the featured speaker at the conference. Somebody pinch me."
Yeah, Stewart to some extent is a Bradshaw wannabe. Bradshaw is his hero.
I can imagine that if you were at a fellowship meeting and somebody got up and wanted to say, I'm upset, but I have a right to my anger, that they wouldn't be able to say it because it would sound so absurd after having heard Stuart Smalley say it.
There are people who have said to me that after, and these are people who enjoy the character, who are in recovery, who say that they do feel a little stupid saying some of the saying some of the things they've heard Stuart say. But I think that might be, I don't think that's bad. I don't think that's bad.
Al Franken works with Saturday Night Live as a writer, performer, and co-producer. His new Stewart Smalley book and audio cassette are both titled "I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me."
We still have time for a short affirmation, so look in the mirror. Come on, don't look at me. Only you can help you. Say, "Hello, me. I am a Kurd. I'm glad I'm a Kurd. I am fun to be with because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. Not everybody, but that's their problem and your problem too." Okay, I'm sorry. This is not my best show, but that's okay because this is Stu Smalley saying, "I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me."
This has been today's Daily Affirmation with Stewart Smalley.
Al Franken will be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about satirizing the presidential campaign. Right now, critic John Powers has a review of the new movie Zebrahead. It's about interracial love. The director, Anthony Drazen, is white, grew up on Long Island, and has said the movie is somewhat autobiographical.
Though you'd never know it from listening to our presidential candidates, we live in a nation torn, no, make that haunted, by race. The real price of that haunting is well captured in Anthony Drazen's unabashedly romantic story of star-crossed lovers. Michael Rapaport plays Zach Glass, a Jewish high school student at a predominantly black high school in Detroit. Like many young white kids, Zach's life is steeped in black culture. His best friend Dee is African-American. Zach talks in homeboy patois. He's even a DJ madly in love with black music. And when he meets Dee's lovely cousin Nikki, played by Nebusha Wright, he falls for her almost immediately. And she responds because Zach and Nikki are instinctively courageous enough to cross the racial divide. But they're also so naive, they have only an inkling of the real cost.
What does your mother think about this? What does she really think about this?
She's not trying to hear it at all. What does your father think?
My father doesn't care who I date. As long as I date regularly, he don't care.
What do your friends think?
You know, my man D's cool with it, right? And the rest of them I don't care about. I don't care what they think.
Their families and friends try to be cool about their relationship. In fact, when Zach's father, a well-meaning, sex-obsessed man, finds his son in bed with Nikki, he celebrates by ordering them all Chinese food. Like any high school kid, Zach greets his father's attempt to be hip with stunned, humiliated resentment. But despite the seeming goodwill of many around them, Nikki and Zach's relationship quickly uncovers the painful racial feelings that everybody normally tries to tiptoe around. Zebrahead is a warm-hearted movie whose virtues are inseparable from its modesty. In the last third, it partly loses its way because Drazen falls into the trap of trying to make a grandiose statement about race in America. And this leads him into melodramatic clichés about murders and funerals, material treated much more powerfully by movies like Boys in the Hood. Last year, Jungle Fever suggested that romantic love between blacks and whites was not merely impossible, but wrong. That was a movie whose ruling emotion was anger. It probably says something important about the difference between black and white experience, that Drazen's dominant emotion in Zebrahead is regret. At one point, Zach takes Nikki to the family business, a downtown record store started by his grandfather. Its walls are covered with photos and dust jackets of all the great black musicians whose music this Jewish family has loved and proudly helped to disseminate. As the young lovers kiss between the record racks, this old, fusty, doomed store is more than simply a holdover from the past. It's a small utopia in which blacks and whites share the same passions and make each other stronger. A utopia that looks farther away all the time.
John Powers is a cultural reporter for LA Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Al Franken has been satirizing presidential candidates on Saturday Night Live ever since the days of Gerald Ford, writing such campaign slogans as, "If he's so dumb, why is he president?" Coming up, Franken talks with us about satirizing this year's campaign. He's been co-writing Bush and Perot sketches with Dana Carvey, and he's been covering the presidential campaign for the Comedy Central channel. And conservative editorial cartoonist Wayne Stascoll tells us about taking aim at Bill Clinton and the Democrats. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Evidence released today calls into question President Bush's claim that he was unaware of the details of the Iran-Contra affair. A note written by then-Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger says Mr. Bush supported the Arms for Hostages deal at a key meeting. The new evidence was part of an indictment brought today against Weinberger. Weinberger's charged with lying to Congress. President Bush addressed a convention of Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise owners this morning in Nashville. The president urged his listeners to consider the impact of their votes. Campaign officials are heartened by new polls that show Mr. Bush is closing the gap with Bill Clinton in Tennessee, NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Tennessee has been considered a stronghold for the Democrats since favorite son Al Gore joined the presidential ticket. Tennessee, however, has voted Republican in most recent presidential elections. President Bush has mounted a serious effort in Senator Gore's territory. Recently, he spent a full day flying around the state, stopping for airport rallies in a half dozen Republican strongholds. This morning, he spoke at Opryland, declaring himself a conservative candidate of change. Mr. Bush's campaign schedule is now focused on traditionally Republican states where voters have been leaning in the direction of the Democrats. Although the Clinton campaign is confident that it's locked up Tennessee, a new Mason-Dixon poll shows the two candidates the closest they've been in months, although new and young voters who generally favor Clinton are not calculated in the survey. I'm Elizabeth Arnold reporting.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Al Gore says President Bush is insulting Americans' concerns about the environment by calling Gore Ozone Man, or simply Ozone. In a speech in New Hampshire today, the Tennessee senator said the president dishonors those who recognize the urgent need for action on the environment. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania are criticizing Russian President Boris Yeltsin's decision to suspend the withdrawal of Russian troops from the Baltic republics. Yeltsin charges Russian-speaking minorities there face discrimination. From Moscow, the BBC's Tim Huell reports.
In all three Baltic states, politicians have reacted indignantly to Mr. Yeltsin's decision, and many have linked it to the Russian president's difficulties at home. The deputy president of Latvia, Andrzej Krastinch, told journalists the move was an attempt by Mr. Yeltsin to appease Russian nationalists who've become increasingly critical of his government. Mr. Krastinch said the instability of Russian politics and the strength of the nationalist lobby posed a threat not only to the Baltics, but to the whole of Europe. Russian officials have suggested there are two reasons for suspending the withdrawal: the lack of accommodation for troops returning to Russia, and concern over the position of ethnic Russians in Latvia and Estonia who do not have automatic citizenship rights. The Deputy Defence Minister, Boris Gromov, told journalists in Moscow he thought the political difficulties over withdrawal were more serious than the economic ones.
The BBC's Tim Huell. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 20 points. This is NPR. Democratic and Republican congressional leaders today urged the TV networks to withhold their projections of election results until polls close on the West Coast. The lawmakers sent a letter to ABC, CBS, CNN, and NBC. They said voters on both coasts have a right to vote without feeling that the election is already over and their votes will make no difference. Earlier this week, the nation's governors and a coalition of women's groups asked TV news organizations to delay broadcasting results until Western polls close. The three networks have not indicated they'll take that advice. CNN has said it won't announce projections in any one state until that state's polls close. Two sharply differing assessments of the Justice Department's environmental enforcement record have been issued in Washington today. NPR's John Nielsen says the reports add fuel to the debate over President Bush's environmental record.
The first report, prepared for the House Judiciary Committee, suggests that Justice Department officials are failing to enforce the nation's environmental laws as vigorously as they should. In off-the-record interviews, regional prosecutors and staffers at the Environmental Protection Agency reportedly complained that high officials at the Justice Department had blocked prosecution of politically sensitive environmental crimes. No specific crimes were mentioned. Spokesman for the Justice Department called the congressional report a politically timed hatchet job, however. They then released their own assessment of the department's environmental record, which noted that in 1992, prosecutors had collected more than $2 billion in environmental fines, an all-time record. President Bush has often cited the administration's environmental enforcement record as proof that he has fulfilled his claim to an environmental presidency. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
A group of native Innu peoples in eastern Canada is refusing to pay its electric bills to protest this week's rejection of a Canadian referendum. The referendum would have given native peoples more self-government. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of the political humor on Saturday Night Live is written by my guest, Al Franken. He's worked with the show on and off since the mid-70s as a writer, performer, and co-producer. Franken has also been co-anchoring the campaign coverage for the Comedy Central cable channel. Earlier on today's show, we talked with him about satirizing the recovery movement through his character, Stuart Smalley. We invited him back to talk about the presidential campaign. In previous seasons on Saturday Night Live, Franken has done impressions of Pat Robertson, Paul Tsongas, and Paul Simon. Now Dana Carvey does Bush and Perot, Phil Hartman does Clinton. I asked Franken if he's tried any of the current presidential contenders.
I can do Perot, not as well as Dana Carvey, and I can do, see, when you write for someone, you can kind of do them, but you only do them well enough to be able to, you know. Perot actually called Dana, and I was on the line, and he wouldn't listen. It was very odd. He called up, and we had left message, because he called to thank us for the first piece we wrote, or tell us how much he enjoyed it. And we got him on the phone, and I was in the line, and Dan would go, well, Mr. Perot, now, here's the deal. If they can make you look like me, they can make me look like Burt Reynolds. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Dana would go, thank you, Mr. Perot. Also on the line is Al Franken, who, now, I hear the deal. If you go out and campaign for me, and we're both out there, it'd be twice as effective. Well, that's very funny, you know. Also on the line is Al. Now, how do they do that? How do they make you look that way? You know, and he just, I didn't get a big listening vibe from the man.
So you've been writing the Perot sketches for Dana Carvey?
I've been writing them actually lately with Dana Carvey. Uh-huh. Dana, once he gets a character,
right,
really, really is hilariously, it can improvise in the character.
Have you been in on the Bush stuff too?
Yes, I do a lot of that with Dana and Jim Downey, and over the years I've been writing that.
When did you start hearing those special cadences that George Bush uses when he really gets going?
You mean the not finished sentences, the bits and pieces of words here, there, over there.
That's it.
It took us actually 3 or 4 times to doing Bush till we finally got him.
You know, I really didn't hear those kinds of sentence fragments in George Bush's speaking style until Dana Carvey started doing it. And then after Dana Carvey, I couldn't listen to Bush without hearing Dana Carvey's doing Bush. And I started wondering if Bush ever heard Dana Carvey doing Bush, and if so, how he could still keep talking that way. It seems to me you'd get so self-conscious about it.
He did, actually. First of all, Dana's been to the White House and has met the president. And it was by invitation. He didn't just sneak in there. I actually remember we were doing, like, wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. We were doing a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And it was, I heard Bush say that at one point, and he said he felt very embarrassed. He just said, wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. And he said, not being Dana Carvey, shouldn't have said that. And he does that. He mentions Dana actually quite a bit. I saw him on something the other day where they saw him backstage. It was like a documentary, and he just went, this is the real me, not Dana Carvey. So he, you know, I think what they do is they give him tapes. And like the one time we ever did anything on the show that supported a Bush policy, they trotted out saying, "See, Saturday Night Live is supporting us on this."
What's this?
Oh, we did a thing. It wasn't him. It was like a during the Gulf War, we did a press briefing thing.
Oh, where, yeah, that's right.
Where the press just keeps asking questions that obviously
would give away important secret information.
Yeah. And lo and behold, Sununu comes out and said, we were going to start opening things to the press, but we saw this sketch on Saturday Night Live, and we realized that the people don't want us to tell the press what's going on.
Well, how'd you feel about that?
Well, I felt like, oh, now, finally, this is the first time that you take any, you know, they're just, I just felt they were lying again. Yeah, that's really what made them decide that.
But the sketch really did criticize the press and take the side of the administration.
I guess it did. It was meant to be a joke, and it was meant to be about the fact that there were some press members who were asking questions you couldn't answer.
Right.
So, and it was taken by the highest levels of our government to mean that, that the press should be kept away from any real information about the war.
Is Clinton hard to do?
I think he is right now. We haven't quite figured him out. I mean, Phil does a great impression of him. But as far as writing him and figuring out what the hook is, we don't quite have it. I mean, there's the conciliator, the person that wants to be something to everybody. There's the person who's, you know, we take advantage of a certain inability to explain, like, the draft and stuff like that, too. In the special tomorrow night, he explains that, you know, I did not see several of the early original Saturday Night Lives because at the time between 77 and 79, Hillary and I were having marital difficulty, and she had thrown my TV out the bedroom window and on the lawn with several of my suits, which she had ripped up. And then later in the show, he goes, earlier in the show, I said that that I didn't see many of the original Saturday Night Lives because Hillary and I were having marital difficulties. And while that is, in essence, true, I did have the time frame mixed up. And it's just like, you know, let's just say that we started having marriage problems about the time Chevy Chase left the show. And they extended to the early Conehead period. Let's just say that during the first Mr. Bill, our marriage was just god-awful. So that was, so, you know, We're using what we can, but eventually we're going to have to really figure the guy out.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. Al Franken is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Al Franken, is a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live. There was a sketch on Saturday Night Live last week, tell me if you wrote this or not, where Perot and Stockdale are driving.
I didn't.
Okay.
That was Dana and Robert Smigel.
Okay.
That was a very, very funny sketch.
Yeah.
I felt a little uncomfortable about it.
How come? And I should mention this. In the sketch, you know, Perot finally, like, throws out Stockdale. He throws him out of the car because he's just really embarrassed by him. He's a real liability.
Well, he tricks him to get out of the car and drives away real fast. I thought it was really funny, and I thought, Dana's Perot's hilarious, and I thought Phil Stockdale was really funny. And to some degree legitimate. I mean, Stockdale, the way events conspired against the guy, he was asked to be a stand-in for as a vice presidential running mate so that Perot could qualify to get on the ballots. In the spring, he needed a name to to be the vice presidential candidate, and he asked Doc Dill to do it on the assumption that he would get another vice presidential candidate, right? And Stockdale said okay, and then when he dropped out, when Perot dropped out, obviously no one would join the ticket in the interim, and then when he jumped back in, there was Stockdale. So, and that was like 10 days, or he jumped back in like 2 weeks or 10 days before the debate. And Stockdale probably didn't even know he had a debate until a few days before. And, you know, Gore and Quayle, you know, eat and sleep this stuff. So, and no one could have done that. And then, but then the performance was so, it was kind of embarrassing and kind of funny. And, but, I mean, he was, prisoner of war for 10 years or 8 years while I was, you know, at college throwing frisbees and smoking pot and protesting against the war. So I feel in a very comfortable position to make fun of the guy.
Right, right.
You know? But this thing he said lately about Clinton having blood on his hands because he organized protests, that didn't make me very happy.
Mm-hmm. How emotionally involved have you been with this campaign?
Well, I guess I should make a disclaimer, which is that I'm always for the Democrat. I always am. And so if you're listening to me, I was for Dukakis. And actually, I voted for John Anderson, which I kind of regret now. But I will be really bummed out on Tuesday if Bush wins. It'll be really hard for me to be anchoring this broadcast. I 4 years ago, I had the honor of hosting, emceeing the Dukakis Victory Party in Boston. So I was up there and and I was the comedian emceeing this event. And my first joke was this, and I went on like at 8 or 9. I can't remember. We knew by then. It wasn't official, but my first joke was, I've prepared two kinds of material tonight. One in case we win, just narrowly win, and the other in case we win by a landslide. And it was actually kind of funny. I mean, it was actually kind of fun because it was just gallows humor night.
What else did you say?
We would do things like every time Sam Donaldson, because Sam Donaldson was up there, every time Sam would come on, you know, we'd see the ABC camera light go on. We would just start chanting, Sam, Sam. And, I started trying to orchestrate everything for the cameras, you know, for when the networks came on to show us. So one point I had, you know, I said, well, you know, let's not cede patriotism to the Republicans. By this time we had lost, really, we had just really lost. So we sang the national anthem, and it was actually quite emotional. And, but woo boy, that was bad. Woo. So I'm not going to be in Little Rock. I'm going to be in New York. I'm going to be the anchor. I have to have some anchor-like objectivity, and which I won't have.
Al Franken, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Al Franken is a writer and performer on Saturday Night Live. He has a new book and audio cassette in the voice of Stuart Smalley, a character he created for Saturday Night Live. The book and tape are called I'm Good Enough, I'm Smart Enough, and Doggone It, People Like Me. We'll talk with conservative political cartoonist Wayne Stascoll after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the campaign today?
We have reports from the campaign trail where the two candidates are making what they're calling the sprint for the finish line, as many states as they can get to between now and Tuesday. We'll have Eric Weiner will have a report for us on Ross Perot's infomercials and whether or not those facts he talks about are really facts. We have we're going to take a look at polls and how they work and why they're different at the gender gap. We have a performance artist who has covered the campaign for us and set it to music, and we'll be talking to some voters from Texas, and we're not forgetting it's Halloween.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Wayne Stascoll has been satirizing the presidential campaign from a conservative perspective. His syndicated political cartoons originate at the Tampa Tribune. In a recent cartoon, a couple is deciding what to watch on TV. The husband says, "What should we watch? Bush is on Larry King, Perot is on Donahue, and Clinton is on Dr. Ruth." Here's another cartoon. A couple of guys are sitting in a neighborhood bar watching Dan Quayle on TV. Quayle is decrying the decline of the American family. And one of the guys at the bar says, "Decline? He doesn't know what he's talking about. I started families in Newark, Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, Miami." Stascoll told me how he came up with that one.
I did hear Dan Quayle decry, as you said, the American family. And it seemed like all of a sudden everybody jumped down his throat and said, the silly guy's going off on that kind of stuff again. And I happen to believe in family values. And so I got to thinking about it, and I thought, hey, you know, there's another side to this, and that's the side I drew about. You know, this guy has this warped view of the family and then how they start and everything else, and hasn't any idea what family values mean. And so, you know, he started families in Newark and Detroit and all across the country.
Do you think you're one of the few cartoonists who isn't mocking Dan Quayle?
Yeah, I believe that you're right. I think that's true. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're missing out on something that everybody?
Oh, absolutely not. Uh-huh. Oh no, I think Dan Quayle's all right. See, I'm one of the few who's in his corner.
Are there many conservative editorial cartoonists in the country?
Yeah, a handful, I guess.
Has it been good for your career to be one of the few conservative political cartoonists?
No, I would say not. No, I would say that probably it's hindered me in getting in more papers. It's probably hindered me in maybe getting some of the bigger prizes. I know there have been two times now that I came in the last grouping in the Pulitzer Prize. They pick four and then they send it up to another committee or so, and the committee picks one of those four. And I've been in that twice, so, I get close, but I never quite quite get it. And I'm assuming, you know, not now, it could be, I can be entirely wrong, you know. Maybe they just say, hey, how in the world did this guy's cartoons get in the mix here, you know. And to answer your question is, I think it hurt a little bit.
Since so many of the political cartoonists are more liberal than you are, when you look at their cartoons, do you find them funny even when you don't agree with the politics, or do you find that you have to agree with the politics to really laugh at the humor?
Oh, no. I think they're funny. There's a Clay Bennett who's over, he's kind of my competitor over in St. Petersburg. And he's the best spokesman for the left I've ever seen. I mean, the guy's great. And I laugh at his stuff, and I don't agree at all with what he's saying, but he's really good. And I just thought, boy, I wish Clay was on our side, because he could tear up a lot of people, you know. He's fantastic.
What's it been like to caricature the three presidential candidates? Have you found interesting ways of drawing them?
Well, again, I until this campaign came up and 4 years back, all the way until the last one, I have rarely drawn a caricature of anybody. I just draw my cartoons from the perspective of the citizen, you know, the man on the street kind of thing. And so this, when the election came up, I was hoping somehow I could figure out how to worm out of doing caricatures, which I do okay. You know, it's okay with me. I like to do them, but somehow I like to get that viewpoint from the guy sitting in his own house looking at his TV or walking down the street or talking to guys in the office or something like that. But to get back to your question, no, I am having a lot of fun drawing the caricatures of the three candidates. And I don't try to make one look evil. Herblock, you know, that great cartoonist, when he drew Nixon, he drew an evil-looking Nixon, you know. But I draw him, you know. Well, maybe Perot. Maybe I have a little more fun with Perot. I give real big ears and a real big nose and hardly nothing at all. But it's not an evil caricature at all. It's just a fun caricature.
Have you come up with a cartoon today?
Yeah, I have, Terry. In fact, it's because of the weekend, I had to draw my Monday cartoon, this morning. So that's going to be my last cartoon of the campaign. And what I did, I've got three desks kind of floating there in my space. And the first one says President Bush on it. And he's got a sign that says, "The buck stops here." And then the second desk is the desk of President Clinton. And he's got a sign that says, "The buck stops here." But then he's got another little sign that says, "Or over there," with an arrow to another sign. The other sign says, "Or there," with an arrow to another sign. And that sign says, "Well, maybe there." And it has it. So it keeps going, you know. And then the last desk I have President Perot, and he says, "The buck stopped here." Then another little sign says, "But I pass it on to a committee."
Right.
So that's the last one I can do on the campaign until four more years from now, which I'm not looking forward to.
Are you relieved that the campaign is about
over?
Oh,
am I ever? Am I ever? Yes, I am. Oh boy, I'm glad. Believe it or not, I don't like doing so many. Well, let's face it, negative cartoons in a row. But I felt I had to tell my story, and the only way I could was to tell what was wrong, as I see it, about Bill Clinton.
Do you think that the way Bush has handled the Iran-Contra affair and the Iraqgate charges is exemplary of buck stops here type behavior?
I wish it would have been better, but I guess all the facts aren't in yet, are they? I don't know. That's what I keep hearing. And I don't think they've pinned anything on him yet, so I don't know. I'll tell you what I'll do. If it comes out that he's the bad guy, I'll do a cartoon about it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much. Appreciated it.
Wayne Stascoll is a syndicated political cartoonist based at the Tampa Tribune. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, legalized bribery and congressional campaigns. We talk with consumer advocate Ralph Nader and conservative Paul Weyrich, who agree that money from lobbyists and special interest groups is corrupting American politics. They'll tell us about some of the latest techniques of secretly bankrolling congressional campaigns. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.